Dear invited speakers, scientists, water managers and water professional, dear students, dear colleagues and friends, it is really a pleasure to welcome you for this international conference on climate change and water in this nice Congress Center. This event is one of common goal: think global, act local. This could be the title of a global hymn against impacts of climate change. So I wrote a song, but maybe it's neither the right place nor the right moment for that. Maybe later today after the cocktail. Okay, forget it. More seriously, who wants to manage water resources today has to integrate climate change threats and opportunities. This is more and more obvious. And the flooding events of these past weeks in France is a engagement, for instance, like 1 year and a half ago, also in the Loire Basin, confirmed this. This is why, during those 3 days, we, as scientists, water managers, and water professionals from more than 46 different countries, we will share international, transdisciplinary, and interprofessional solutions. What are local indicators and signals of the impacts of climate changes? What are the adaptation strategies? Have they already been tested somewhere? Are they coherent with mitigation goals? And finally, is the local governance ready and efficient for such perspectives? What could be improved? And one key question: who are the key stakeholders? Water, 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 and water again. Do I forget something?
Yes, Isabelle. That wasn't prepared, huh? Biodiversity. Water is a resource for us as humans, but it is also an habitat for a huge biodiversity. Yet this biodiversity is under threat, not only from humans' activities, but also from climate change. So what are the local signals, local signs of erosion of biodiversity in aquatic environments, and how can we manage natural ecosystems and agro-systems coherently with water resources?
Yes. Excuse me, Sylvain.
I excuse you.
Climate change threat all scales of water and all dimensions of water. The eminent researcher Jean Jouzel from Météo and Climat Association, who I personally thank for his presence today, when I know he's very much solicited, he will explain better than I that we absolutely have no more time for doubts. This being said, I would like to thank, first of all, the region and the Regional Water Agency for their financial support, but also the DAL, the Loire River Workshop Cluster, and the CNRS laboratories CITER and IRBI, and the municipality of Tours. Then I would like to thank all the members of the scientific committee, and in particular Ralf Ludwig and Peter Brezik for organizing an ECRA, European Climate Research Alliance, session. I would like to thank the members of our two networks, MIDI and DREAM, for their help in the organization of the committee. And also the people of INRA, the National Research Institute of Agronomy, and in particular the secretaries for the time dedicated to the event. Also, students of the Department of Geography, thank you for your help for those 3 days. And last but not least, I would like to give a particular thank to the animator of our media network, Alexia Susen, for her investigation and professionalism, as you may know that organizing such an event is full of administrative tasks that we, as scientists, have sometimes difficulties to appreciate the outlines. So we wish you to enjoy this conference and your time in this nice city of Tours. So I invite Jean Jouzel, climatologist with a recognized reputation in glaciology, and Emeritus Research Director at CNRS in Paleoclimatology, at the Laboratory for Climate Environmental Sciences at the Pierre-Simon Laplace Institute in Paris. Jean Jouzel has received several awards and honors during his career. I cannot list today, but on the 12th October 2007, he received the Nobel Peace Prize along with the IPCC members and the US Vice President Al Gore. Because he was at the moment the vice chairperson of the IPCC Working Group PRAN. Since 2009, Jean Jouzel is the president of the French Association Météo et Climat, which actively contributes to the dissemination of scientific knowledge on climate change.
So, good morning. Thanks to Isabel to help me. I invite Isabel to help me, and I would like to thank her for the, to thank you, Isabel, for the organization of this meeting, and all those who cite as the two networks and all colleagues here. And I am very happy to say a few words for opening this conference. So, this conference is on local aspects of climate change and water issues. I will say a few words more on a global aspect of climate change. First, this climate change is a reality. As you can see, it works. Oh, it doesn't. Oui, hop. As you can see here, you have the last 4 years, which are the warmest year over the last, over the recent period, indeed, over the last 150 years. And we still, 2016 is the warmest year, but 2017 is the warmest year without any new events. You see all this year with in red, with any new events, they are generally above the general trend of the warming. The contrary for El Niño years, I would say 2017 is a neutral year, but it's the warmest year without any new event. What we know is that warming is more important on the continents than on the ocean, and the warming is even more accentuated in the high northern latitude in the Arctic, with warming which is twice larger than at the global scale. So this warming is not a surprise. It's not a surprise because what we are doing over the last 2 centuries or so is to increase the amount of, to modify the composition of the atmosphere and to increase the amount of greenhouse gases. The first greenhouse gases is water vapor, what we don't change the amount of water vapor directly. We change it indirectly because global warming results in a warming of the ocean surface and more evaporation. Indeed, we have more water vapor in the atmosphere now than 20 years ago. What is the consequence of this increase in greenhouse gases? More than 40% for CO2 and more than multiplied by 2 for methane, 20% for nitrous oxide. The result is that you increase the amount of heat available for the various components of the climate system. We have increased over the last 200 years the amount of heat available by 1%, something like 1%. Indeed, the increase linked with greenhouse gases is more than 3 watts per square meter, so slightly more than 1%. But one part of it is counteracted by pollution. It's also anthropogenic activities, and pollution contribute to cooling effect, roughly 20% of the warming, which is due to this increase of greenhouse gases. So what we are doing, we increase heating, we increase the energy in the climate system, and there is no surprise, we have a warming. What is important is that, so we have additional heat, but what is important is that of this additional heat, only 1% is used by the atmosphere. Clearly, it's important to look at what occurs in the atmosphere, but we should also see what is going on in the cryosphere, and more importantly, in the ocean, where 93% of the this additional heat is used. But first, only to remind you that this emission of greenhouse gases are very well documented. They are documented by gas, CO2 and other gas. So this increase, more than two-thirds, 70% is due to the increase is largely due of greenhouse gases is largely due to carbon dioxide. Next is methane and nitrous oxide. So this is very well documented by sector of activity, by country, by contribution. And this is clearly increasing. This is another problem, that emission of greenhouse gases, I will come back on it, are still increasing. So what is occurring in the ocean? This is very important. We have sea level rise over 3 millimeters per year. 1 millimeter is due to the thermal expansion. The ocean is warming, and clearly warming, and it's expanding. So this accounts for roughly speaking, one third of the sea level rise every year. And more than half of this sea level rise is a result from the melting of ice, ice in temperate glaciers, but more, over the last 20 years also, there is a clear contribution of Greenland and Antarctica. This is clear, and for example, Greenland is also not far from contributing, slightly less than 1 millimeter for every year to sea level rise. And in Antarctica, it's the contribution comes from West Antarctica, this part of Antarctica, which is directly south of South America. So this is clear. What you have in sea level rise are two indicators of I would say climate warming, thermal expansion, and melting of ice. And so this is clear. This is a clear indication of global warming, even more clear than in the atmosphere. We can also see to look at the cryosphere with a decrease of spring cover, snow cover. We have 2 million square kilometers less covered with snow at the end of the spring than 50 years ago, and we have also a clear decrease of the expansion of sea ice at the end of when this expansion is minimum at the end of the summer. So next question is that we have a warming. We increase the heating, but is there a relationship between these two phenomena, these two observations? Yes, the answer is clearly yes, since, when you look at, this comes from the more recent IPCC report. Indeed, I mentioned that I was a vice chair of the IPCC scientific group for 15 years, not And this, as you can see, when you look at the more recent period, you have, since the last 50 years, we have a warming of slightly more than half a degree, which can
largely be explained by greenhouse gases, and you have this counteracting effect of pollution. And overall, I mean, you see that what we can explain by anthropogenic forcing is really in line with the observation over this period. On the other hand, natural forcing, either, I mean, what is solar activity, change in solar activity, or volcanic activity, or cannot explain more than one-tenth of degree. So our conclusion is clear. A large part of this warming results from human activities. So we are in a world we are clearly modifying. So where do we go? This is our decision at some point. But if we do nothing, is where we will be at this stage at the end of the century, with a global warming between 4 and 5 degrees C, up to 10 degrees C warming in the Arctic, more than 5 degrees C on some part of continental area, slightly less, between 2, 3 degrees C and over the ocean. But you see, this is a completely different world. It's the same difference between today and the end of the century and between the last glacial maximum and today, but with a higher rate of, 50 to 100 times higher rate of change. So this is a very different climate if we do nothing. So if we do nothing, so this is emitting scenario. At the end of the century, you see that we will be at 4 to 5 degrees C. I show the plot, but it's far to be stabilized. We can continue and reach 6 to 8 degrees C at the end of the next century. So what are the consequences? So there are, generally we use 5 categories of consequences. I will not go in too many details, but so here I am wrong for something. So in red are the ones which are influenced by, made a mini mistake, I realize. In red are the ones which are influenced by the water cycle directly, and this is the case too for biodiversity, clearly. It's clear that biodiversity is also not only natural ecosystem, agriculture, but also biodiversity. So I will comment more on the ones which are influenced by the water cycle. So what about the water cycle first is that general view. I mean, you can only see that, the one consequence of global warming is to extend the Hadley Cell, and so to change the zone of precipitation. This zone will shift poleward, both in southern hemisphere and northern hemisphere, which associated dying in the descending branch of the Hadley Cell. And also another consequence of atmospheric circulation change is wetter conditions projected in high latitudes. Okay, so this is a general, general results, but if we look at details, you see this is translated in precipitation. So you have zone where you have a decrease of precipitation. We see also an evaporation. There are larger change in evaporation, but relative humidity will decrease, generally speaking, in the air. And so air will be slightly drier. And evaporation minus precipitation, you see that it increases in zone where you will have less, obviously, water available. And you see what are these zones, and it's probably more clearer. It's clearer when you look at what you are interested in, runoff and soil moisture. And you see that the region where you have decrease of runoff and soil moisture are in red. And you see on blue you are an increase, and one of the really clear spot of change is the Mediterranean. This is not the only one. We talk more, I mean, we generally focus on the Mediterranean because it's our region, but it's also true, you see, for, I would say, California, for part of South America, for the southern part of Africa, and indeed there are a lot of drought, there are serious drought in this region. And you see, obviously, no surprise, there will be also a lot of regions where you have decrease of soil moisture. So these are not good news. So these are not good news for the Mediterranean. So when you look at the Mediterranean, I took another plot. You see the details. So I will focus on first on the right, on what's happened in the summer. So the green area here and increasing in the northern part of precipitation, and in the bottom part, in marron, what you say, on yellow and marron, you have a decrease up to 50% decrease on the amount of precipitation in a lot of on summer. So you have so this is a real problem because in summer you have decrease of precipitation, increase of evaporation, and clearly. This will lead to less runoff, and this was the case this year in the Rhône Valley, for example. The flux of Rhône decreased by 30%. I mean, this last in October. So, on the contrary, and this is the situation where we are, there is a risk of more precipitation in winter. And in particular of the western, on the western part of Europe, under the influence of the Atlantic Ocean. And it's clear that, there is discussion. We understand the risk of this relatively mild winters that we have now, and there will be more and more frequent, which will be associated with more precipitation during winter. This is a simple way to see things. We can go more details, but this is a risk. So we have the risk of, for example, in Western Europe, of more floods in winter and less, over the Mediterranean in particular, less water available in summer. This is a general picture, but we have also, when we look at France, for example, there are articles which tend to show that it's very surprising flooding in 2016 because it was at a period, in May and June, which is unusual, could be also, there is a larger risk in a warmer climate, and there are also a lot of discussion on Mediterranean events. So these extremes are, there's still a lot of work, but generally speaking, and I think this is the next slide. Extremes will try to become more extremes. So here again, I have in red are the extremes which are interested in the water cycle. One characteristic is that we will have more intense precipitation. It's already the case, at least in some part of the northern hemisphere. So again, more heavy precipitation means more risk of floods, and this will be very likely in the second part of this century. For the droughts, it's also an increase of, very likely means more over 90% chance, likely 67% chance. And it's also true for drought. For cyclones, we are very cautious, but there is a risk, at least in some parts of in the Atlantic, there is a risk of increase of the intensity of cyclone. And as far as precipitation are concerned, one side that there could be a possible increase of 20% of the maximum amount of precipitation in cyclones. So, which is, as you know, the amount of precipitation associated with the cyclone is also part of the risk. And the last one is for sea level rise. It's also a water cycle at some points, but I will go more rapidly. I don't want. So associated with also lack of water, droughts, or this risk of forest fires. I mean, heat waves. I mean, this was the case, for example, in Portugal in June. I mean, so you have temperature of over 40 degrees, and in June, and with I mean, at the end of a drought, and you have this risk of forest fires. And for example, if you look at the at the left side for you, yes, sorry, you see that there is practically no risk in the center of France and west of France of forest fire, no. And there will be risk of forest fire in this region here in a warmer world, it's clear. I mean, this is what the main message for me of this plot is that central part of and western part of France will be somewhat at risk of forest fire after 2050. So it's very important for agriculture, for productivity, and water is very important. And it's clear, I mean, as we expect, when we look at crop productivity, here, I mean, it's for the main maize, soy, rice, and wheat. You have some region which gain in productivity, they are in blue, and some other regions which are losing in productivity, mostly because of droughts and heat waves. And you see at the end of this, I mean, over the next 10 years, there is balance between those regions who gain in productivity and the regions who are losing in productivity. But at the end of the century, it's clear that the regions who are losing in productivity are much more important than the ones which are still gaining. Okay, so overall, I mean, there will be a decrease in crop productivity over the world. This is a planetary scale, but it's very important also. Sea level, it's also somewhat the water cycle. It's somewhat very important because the coastal, I mean, you know, at the end of the century, I mean, in this case, still of emitting scenario, you can reach not far from 1 meter, and there are some suggestions that this would be even more, I mean, over 1 meter. And what is more important, this will is irreversible and will certainly last over centuries. And there is a risk that, for example, if the warming still, is over 2-3 degrees during 1 millennium, I mean, at the millennium time scale, there is a risk of melting of Greenland, which represents 7 meters of sea level rise. So this is also a problem in some region of Vosley, and with associated floods also. So what can we conclude? That, and this was, I think, the title of this talk. We can conclude that we cannot accept this possibility of doing nothing. It's not for future generation. It's for you. I mean, there are a lot of students here. It's for you. I mean, when we talk of the second part of this century, you will be here. This is clear. So what can we do? I would say a politician or negotiator know what we should do. And indeed, it was a decision of the Climate Convention to have an objective to limit global warming well below 2 degrees C in the Paris Agreement, or even at 1.5 degrees C, which is what is the idea behind this, is that if we do so, we will be able to adapt. I mean, the hope is that we will be able to, adapt at least for the essential part of the global warming. But still, I mean, for example, I mean, we cannot avoid sea level rise of something like 50 centimeters in addition, probably 1 meter at the end of the next century, 50 centimeters or 40 at the end of this century. So, I mean, it will be a different climate. When we talk of 2 degrees C above pre-industrial, it's over 1 degree C if we look at the more recent years. So, to do so, the problem is that to do so, it's really a challenge. I'm well in line with his objective myself. We should do that, but it's maybe too late because we should completely change of model of development. We should use less than 20% of the reserves of the fossil fuel reserves that we can have, which is a drastic change. We have less than 20 years of CO2 emission at the current rate of emission. So it's possible if we have rapid stabilization of greenhouse gases emission, 2020 at the latest, division by Earth of a factor 3 between 2020 and 2050, and carbon neutrality should be ensured at the end of the century, and most of the scenario evoked negative emission. So at some point what we are doing now, not only we are going towards a climate which will need adaptation at the least, but also we ask new generation, the young, to find a way to pump CO2 from the atmosphere. This is clearly what we are doing now. So I want not to be pessimistic. It's technically feasible and economically viable. We can discuss of this, but I will not be too long. So a rapid look at the Paris Agreement, which was a success, but indeed the success of the Paris Agreement lies in the fact that this agreement is universal. It's the first agreement of this type which has been signed by all countries around the world. For the moment, the Paris Agreement has been signed by all countries over the world. Not ratified, but a lot of countries have ratified this agreement. So I will not go into detail, but there are also a lot of work to do on this contribution of developed countries to help developing countries in terms of adaptation and also mitigation of climate change. The problem of this Paris Agreement is not in its objective, which is very clear. We mention 2 degrees C, but we also mention 1.5 degrees C, and I think that Eric will evoke the 1 degree C report. I will not do this. But this is very important. So the point is that for the moment, with the contribution which are proposed by the country, we are far from the objective. Indeed, we have at the horizon of 2030, we have an excess of 35 to 30% of greenhouse gas emission. Even if the Paris Agreement is taken seriously by our countries. So we are going towards 3 to 3.5 degrees C. No, this is clear if we do nothing more than the Paris Agreement. And it will be too late in 3 years. And so there are weaknesses, so 2 week contribution, and obviously we can mention Trump withdrawal, but this is try to explain why is one plot, a more recent plot, to explain why we have we should reach this peak of emission very rapidly, because simply speaking, if we don't do so, it would be impossible to decrease at the rate. If we do, even in 2055, it would be too late probably to have the correct rate of decrease between 2025 and 2060. I don't say it's too late. It's still possible, but we have to change and to move rapidly if we want to do it. We are not on the way to do it. It's clear. For example, if we look at CO2 emission for 2017, interestingly, CO2 emission were practically, stabilized over 2014, 15, and 16. At least, for example, when you look at China, which is the first emitter, but it has started to increase again by 2% in 2017. So this is bad news. This is clearly bad news. And also, probably I did not mention, but it's clear that CO2 methane concentration are again increasing. They were stabilized, I mean, not far to stabilize in the year 2000, but they are again increasing. So this is only one access, one point to show that it's feasible. But I will not. It's also a matter of investment. For example, for the energy cycle, I mean, it's clear that if you have money, the best way to invest in energy efficiency. But you have to divest clearly of fossil fuel. I clearly think that the future is on renewable. So again, that is one point which is important, and I will finish my talk here. We are in a situation that if we want to do things, we have to invest a lot of money. I mean, and I was very pleased that in the Paris Agreement, one of the point was to that. UN Nation, I mean, the Climate Convention invite clearly the financial sector to make finance flows consistent.